This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
...and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Belinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Glenn Holt.
And Brian Levinka.
And we have something very special coming up at the beginning of the program, so I'm going to leave you hesitant and waiting to find out what that is. But first, later on in the program, the Lesbian Health Initiative Valentine Dinner and Dance is coming up, and we'll have somebody here to talk about that. It's going to be at the Renaissance Hotel, Greenway Plaza, and of course the Lesbian Health Initiative's mission to promote women's health in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered communities. Brad Odom, the president of the board of directors, gives us an update on what's in store for the 2009 season of Pride Celebration Houston. For over 30 years, it's been Pride Houston has worked for the heart of the local GLBT community to increase awareness and equality in our city. Also, Tom Zeppelin, a massage therapist, will be in to talk to us about what that's all about. And we have our regular features from This Way Out, including News Wrap. But coming up here very shortly, her candidacy for mayor for the city of Houston was made official last week. It's her third term as city controller. It's our city's elected fiscal watchdog. It's Anise Parker, and she will be joining us shortly, hopefully.
Yes. And, of course. We also have the This Way Out, which has some interesting stories for both national and international. We will try to play the, not this week, but in the future weeks, we'll try to play audio file, which we missed because we were away, and that's part of JD's contribution to This Way Out. We're able to get those back programs a lot easier, so we will try to keep you up to date on all that stuff. We are definitely looking forward to this election year because there's a lot of things going on, and in fact, there's going to be a special election May 9th, is it?
Yep, May 9th.
For District H, which is to fill the seat left by Adrian Garcia, which will be our guest next week.
Yes, next week at this time, Adrian Garcia, the new sheriff in town, will be here, and we'll interview him on his first month or so in the office and what we can look forward to seeing in the upcoming year.
So that sounds really interesting. He's taken over, and he has a lot of work ahead. And actually, you met with him.
Yes, I met with him on Monday of, a Friday of last week. And it was very interesting, and he was following up on some of the initiatives that he had spoken about before to the community, and not just the GLBT community, but I've talked to him about those things. A lot of the things having to do with HIV, the jail, and an initiative in the jail to get individuals who are incarcerated the help they need other than just locking them up. Their mental conditions, health conditions, HIV positive. And also when identified HIV positive individuals are released, they'll be transported over to the necessary community organizations to help them out once they're out.
Well, that's great because pretty much nobody had access to the jails before, and it looks like
it's only been recently that Adrian, one of the things that a number of black ministers had been banned or barred from the jails for 15 years, which just happened to be the length of time that Tommy Thomas was there, and he invited them in to visit with and talk to the inmates. And it was just a very special moment when he was able to do that.
That's great. And upcoming shows, we will be talking about a lot of different community organizations that are, coming up. We've got the AIDS Walk happening rather soon, and a few other things.
Yes, when is the AIDS Walk?
AIDS Walk is March 15th, Sunday. Sam Houston Park downtown, walking down Allen Parkway.
It's a 5K walk.
5K walk. Now, where is it, and how do you get in touch with the people concerning it?
Well, you can join a team on AIDSWalkHouston.org.
Mm-hmm.
You can form your own team, or you can just donate to the cause on the website. The teams have formed, there's maybe 30, 40 teams, and they set a goal for $800,000 this year, and they're feeling pretty confident about that. I'm on my team, the number one team, Center for AIDS. Plug.
Well, this raises money not just for the AIDS Foundation, but for a lot of other...
Well, they have between 12 and 15 partner organizations that get 75% of what they raise, and 25% goes to the AIDS Foundation Houston for the administrative costs. So it's kind of a win-win. They raise money and they get, you know, the majority of it back. And it's kind of competitive because we have the different organizations that are trying to be the top dog, like Legacy and Bering and Center for AIDS.
Do you get to choose what organization the money goes to?
No, or it's the
split up.
It's split to the chosen partner agencies. But it's last year they raised $1 million, and it's, if you haven't been before, it's a really energizing event. It's great to see all the different teams out there walking along Allen Parkway with all their different color shirts. It's like a river of people.
And then Easter's coming earlier this year, isn't it?
It is April 12th.
Because oh, my God, that is much earlier.
Yes, this year is going to actually be a special year for Easter in Houston. This is the 30th anniversary of Bunnies on the Bayou.
What's their event going to be like this year?
Well, they're planning some special stuff. They had the kickoff party yesterday, and I attended that, and it was a great time. That's where they kick off their fundraising, and they have some surprises in store. And they have announced that they are going to bring back DJ Dan Metter, who DJed several years.
Yes.
So that's a great, I think that's a great thing.
Yes, Dan has been the official weather forecaster for Pride for many years.
He does a good job. He's my weatherman. So,
although we don't usually see him on the air.
No, you know, he's always on like Friday or Saturday nights. I never see him. So,
joining us is Anise Parker,
controller for the city of Houston and candidate for mayor of Houston. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I was just out chatting with folks out in the lobby, and I got dragged in here. Sorry, I was schmoozing.
Well, you've run for office and won six times at large, three terms as city council and three terms now as controller, which is a maximum you can do in each office, which I think is a little bit too short to really understand and learn all the inner consequences of what goes on. With that background, you're now planning to run for mayor.
Correct.
Okay. And what do you bring to the table? Like, I don't know, but a lot of our listeners probably don't know you as well as we do.
Houstonians want a mayor who can navigate the city through tough economic times. We don't know how long this recession is going to last, but it's going to be painful. We're going to have to trim expenses. We're going to have to watch our spending down at City Hall. And I have the skills and experience to run the city under any conditions, but certainly in the difficult circumstances that we're going to face.
Well, and so far Houston's doing a little bit better than some other cities, but we don't know what's down the pike, of course.
We have to be cautious. We are probably better off than any other big city in America. We've been buoyed by the strength of the oil and gas economy here. Those high oil prices that we had helped the city of Houston. And fortunately, in the city, the mayor and I, we raised our cash reserves. We took the opportunity to refinance debt. We did a lot of prudent things in advance. And he has offered some realistic budgets to city council, so we didn't get we didn't go on a spending spree when times were good. So we're prepared. We don't know how long it's going to last. We have to make sure that we have enough to get through to the end.
Traditionally, the controller and the mayor usually were at odds with each other. It didn't seem to happen these past 6 years, at least publicly.
We don't agree all the time. It's the nature of the job. I'm really the only person in city government, the only single person in city government who can tell the mayor no. And that just doesn't make make any mayor happy. On the other hand, when we took office, we had both heard loudly and clearly from the voters that they wanted a mayor and controller who were independent of each other, but who were professional in their dealings. And I said right up front, you're not ever going to read what I think about something in the newspaper, that I would call you and talk to you directly. And he told me the same, and he has made sure that when I need information about the financial status of anything going on in the city, that I get it. So it's there's still the independence, but we a much more professional and business-like atmosphere.
A lot has happened in the past couple of years. A friend of ours, Tony Bell, was in town this past weekend, who used to live here many years ago and hasn't been back for, like, I guess 6 or 8 years or something. He says he just can't believe how much it's changed. The Midtown, the Discovery Green Park, there's been a lot of the two new stadiums that we have downtown. The whole, in fact, what's really interesting, when I moved here like 25 years ago, there was all this talk about building in the east side of downtown. That never happened, but it's happened recently. There's been a lot of additional facilities and parks and stadiums and stuff, and that I guess is sort of like we're at a point now where we're going to slow down a bit.
Perhaps there's a lot of stuff in the pipeline. Again, it depends on how long this recession lasts, but we are still growing in Houston. We've created more jobs in Houston over the last 5 years than any other region in America. People have been moving to Houston. We're one of the fastest growing regions in the country, and we are still growing. The growth has slowed down, but and it's odd. There have been layoffs in Houston, but there are still jobs being created in other sectors. So we're still in, we're kind of tip either way. Again, for example, if the oil prices rebounded to $65, $70 a barrel, you'd see us pop right back up.
Well, there is a lot of building going on. Is there enough people to move into these places, whether it's housing or office space? I mean, it's definitely slowed down, and it's not like the 80s, but there still is growth here.
It's not like the 80s. Again, it depends on how long the national recession, if it grows into a depression, how long it lasts, what the impact will be here. What has saved us again thus far is we didn't have the housing bubble. Prices flattened out, but they didn't collapse. The people who had adjustable rate mortgages could go out and if they had decent credit, could refinance. What happened in a lot of other cities is that the value of the properties fell below the mortgage value, and we didn't see that here. And then again, with the oil prices where they were, the oil companies, they invested here, they put money out into the local economy, and so we had a buffer from some of the other things that were going on.
Now, you talked about the fact that we have money in the bank. Where does Houston get its money? How does Houston get funded?
Half of our revenue comes from property taxes. A third, 30% comes from sales taxes. Another maybe 12%, 10 or 12% from franchise fees, and then everything else.
And where does the money go then?
I love to tell people, the traffic tickets, speeding tickets, it's only 2%. It's a rounding error in the budget. Yeah. We really don't balance our budget on traffic enforcement.
When you're paying them, it feels like it.
And where does it? Yeah, I know. I've paid my fair share.
Or the fact that you now have to pay for parking on Saturdays downtown. But
that's because of the growth in retail and entertainment district in downtown. There are great restaurants and clubs down there. When downtown was a wasteland and no one wanted to come down there on the weekend, yeah, you had free parking. Now we have to make sure that there's some turnover at the curb, and that's a good thing. Your question was going to be, where do we spend the money? One-third of the city budget by itself goes to one department. That's the police department. Then you add the other public safety departments, and that's two-thirds of the city budget. That's fire and 911 and all of that. So that squeezes parks and libraries and the health department and all the administrative functions into that remaining third of the budget.
And how many employees does the city have?
Approximately 21,000.
And how many of that are police?
Something under 5,000. It's officers, civilian and classified.
Now, recently, the courts have been shut down because of computer virus. What's going on there? Don't they check that?
They do. And I'm sure heads are rolling over in the IT division. I don't know the current status, but we're constantly on the alert. With those many departments and those many employees, 21,000 employees and thousands of computers linked to the internet, there are protections out there, but all it takes is one idiot plugging in a jump drive into something and downloading the wrong thing. It's very hard to...
Well, what is the size of our budget for the city?
The general fund, which is the budget I described, is just under $2 billion. The general fund is the tax-supported budget, but we also have enterprise funds.
Mm-hmm.
And those enterprise funds are the airport system. We own the three airports, and we just renamed Ellington Field into Ellington Airport. We own three airports. We have the convention and entertainment facilities, and we have the water sewer system. And all of those are, the monies have to be kept segregated. In fact, as we've been dealing with the very difficult credit markets last year, it sounds kind of funny, but because we have four very large pools of money, the general fund and the three large enterprise funds, we can, and my office handles the city's investments. We have an investment portfolio of about $2 billion, and we also have debt of about $12 billion, and we do some short-term borrowing. We use the money available on the investment side to buy debt from one of the other enterprise funds. So when we couldn't borrow money anyplace else for the general fund, we borrowed it from our enterprise funds, and that was great to have. Strong and healthy enterprise funds so we could cross-pollinate.
Now, part of I understand part of the fact that we're in good health is because you instituted as a controller some internal audits, systems that really hadn't been utilized in the past.
Well, we've always done, the controller's office has always done audits, but the new thing was that after I became controller, I went to the voters and asked for authority to do performance or management
audits. Right, yeah, okay.
And no controller had the ability to do that. Occasionally, the mayor would allow a controller to do that. And we've identified millions of dollars in potential savings for the city through these performance audits. And that's the difference is we did cash handling audits and inventory audits before, but this is going in and saying, can you do this more efficiently or effectively? For example, and actually we've also changed some of the ways that we do business to catch up with technology. We're saving $1 million a year on an initiative straight out of the controller's office because we went to a paperless payroll. $1 million a year in paper and distribution costs because every 2 weeks we would print paychecks for a significant number of our employees, but those who didn't get a paper paycheck still got a paper printed advice that had to be handed to them in the office.
And that's just been in the past few years.
It's just been in the last year that we went to the paperless payroll.
Now, you got started.
It's one of those, it's like, duh.
Yes. We're talking to Anise Parker, who has announced running for city mayor, which the election will be in November. And KPFD is a nonprofit organization and does not endorse any candidate. And we will have this form open to other people so if they so request.
I've been hanging around with my 13-year-old too much. Well, duh.
How did you get started in politics?
The very first campaign that I volunteered in was Eleanor Tinsley for city council. And I had that back in the late 70s. She was a longtime school board member, but that was really before my time. This was the first local race I ever paid any attention to, and she was running to take out a long-term incumbent, and he attacked her for her support with queers and oddwads, is I think how he referred to it, and she was so strong. She's been referred to as a steel magnolia, and she absolutely is always a lady, always elegant, but just tough as nails and just would never back down to anything. And she knocked off this 20-year incumbent and then stayed 16 years in city government and absolutely transformed many of the things we do. She created the smoking ordinance for the city of Houston. She created Spark Parks. She worked on bicycle helmets for kids, all sorts of things. And that just, I wanted to do some of the same things.
And so then you got involved in working in neighborhood associations?
Actually, before then, I got involved in the gay community. I was an activist. I went to Rice University. I helped found the gay student organization there, and then got involved in the what was then the Gay Political Caucus, which became the Gay Lesbian Political Caucus, which became whatever it is now. Morphed up.
Houston Gay Lesbian Bisexual Transgender Political Caucus.
I knew you would jump in there, Jennifer. It's changed a lot over the years, but I spent about 10 years as an officer or board member of virtually every political every political organization, gay political organization in the state, and finally decided I had enough of that. And then I got involved in my civic club. I was the president of the Neartown Association, the Neartown CDC, my own smaller civic association. And civic associations are very close to city government. It's about potholes and trash pickup and all the things that we need from city government. And after about 10 years of doing that, I needed a new challenge, so I ran for office.
And why did you decide to run citywide rather than a district?
My first race wasn't a district race. And it was actually during the redistricting battles of 1991, and I lost that race. Old-timers will remember we were trying to go to single-member districts, 16 single-member districts, instead of the split system where we have 9 districts and 5 at-large.
And previous it was all at-large districts.
Previously it had been all at-large, and we went to the split system, and we were trying to go to all single-member districts. And in the midst of all these fights, I filed for what I hoped would be a single-member district. Then it was the Montrose in the Heights. And the plan got shot down, and I was geared up to run, and I was angry, and got a lot of support from other folks who were trying to in this effort, and just kept on campaigning. Ended up running against an incumbent and lost. But I didn't see a district that fit what I offered to the voters. The demographics in Montrose, I lived in Montrose at the time. I ran after that, and there were strong African-American candidates. It was a majority African-American district, and I was really close to several of the people that were running. I didn't want to run against one of them, and there seemed to be more opportunities running citywide. I was right, and have been very successful.
And what would you like some of the plans that you would like to accomplish if you become mayor?
First and foremost, the city has to work. We are going to be facing a very difficult economy, and the new mayor has no margin for error. Has to be able to get in there and make sure that the police are on the street, the firefighters are out there working, that we get the bills paid, and we make sure that the potholes get filled, and all the things that a city has to do and has to do every day. After that, I have always been was a quality of life council member. I worked on a whole range of neighborhood issues, environmental issues. I'm still going to be interested in those and want to work on them. And it's going to be a matter of making sure that the very scarce resources we have take care of the necessities, but that we also don't forget those things that make Houston a place where someone would want to move.
And what would some of those issues be?
Well, for one thing, I don't think we have fully exploited the biosystem that we have in the city of Houston. If we're going to be a cleaner, greener city, let's start with our waterways. And there are...
I wouldn't know what they look like if they weren't brown.
Well, it's not just the water itself, although water quality is an issue, but we still have areas that haven't been completely channelized that are urban wildlife corridors.
Is that a county issue or a city issue?
It's a little bit of both. The flood control district, the county flood control district, manages the water flow through the bios. But we, as a city, can make sure that we develop the ribbon of green on either side of that waterway into a better linear park system.
Like the Sabine Promenade that was done in the past couple of years.
Correct. Correct. You're going to see a lot more cooperation, I think, between the city and the county. For a long time, there were huge turf issues. But now, we're on things like parks and libraries, where we both do parks, we both do libraries, we're thinking about it ahead of time. And instead of putting a similar facility a couple of miles apart, we're coordinating what we do. One will put the land in, one will put the building in. And figuring out where it makes more sense and makes your tax dollars go farther.
One question to follow up on that, and that, if you live in Houston, you live near a bayou, but
we call them bios down here.
Bayou.
No, that's Louisiana. It's bio down here.
Oh, well, okay. One of the things was, is that, are we going to run into any environmental problems? Because I know a lot of the bios.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah. They're overgrown. I mean, it's not just, you've got some trees and they look nice, but you get down with the below 10 feet above or 10 feet above the ground, it's all just solid underbrush. And so what are you going to do about that? Environmentally, is that going to be possible to really clean up the bios?
Actually, when you get down into the waterway, that does become largely the work of the flood control district, because the goal, and one of the reasons that we went through that just awful channelization period where we concreted in a lot of our bios,
right,
was to move the water faster. And you want to make sure that they're not obstructions and that the water moves. And when you have a lot of debris down in the bottom, mm-hmm. you know, catching stuff, and you end up building impromptu dams as things go on. So you have to make sure that gets cleaned out. But when it's, you want to preserve a kind of wild feel to some of those bios, because we have a lot of wildlife that mm-hmm. depend on them, but it also has to be something where people will want to walk along the edge, where mm-hmm. there are habitat for birds and butterflies, and it's not filled with trash. And that's really the biggest problem with the biosystem. A couple of weekends ago, for the inauguration of the new president, in the day of service, I went out with the group over in the Heights. The Heights Democrats and the Tejano Democrats went out and picked up trash along White Oak Bio, and we're bag after bag, and frankly the worst thing are those little plastic bags you get at the grocery store that just clinging to the trees and mm-hmm. and everywhere. So you know, it's not just, so it's trash, it's the plants that are there. We have a lot of problem with invasive species too. When I was a council member, I created a what we call a natural areas ordinance, and I had to work with the flood control district because I wanted an ordinance that would prohibit certain noxious plants. Like, we don't want you to plant tallow trees, for example. And I had to work with the flood control district because we didn't want an ordinance that would penalize them, but we also wanted to encourage people to plant bird and butterfly habitat. And worked closely with the flood control district because a lot of their land needs to be cleared of invasive species. And they, you know, there are opportunities for citizens to get involved, and we're getting way far afield here, but there are a lot of neat things that citizens can do that benefit all of us and make it, as I said, a cleaner, greener city that's better for the wildlife.
And there are city groups, citizens groups that work with the parks departments in certain areas of town. Of course, we always should be more to plant trees, I guess, and to work in together on it. Now you're gonna possibly make history if you win this election. You have won 6 citywide elections so far.
I have actually run 8 times in the city of Houston, 7 times citywide. I lost my that first kind of weird race where I didn't intend to run against an incumbent, but I did. Lost the second time. There was a special election, 6-week campaign. 19 candidates, and I finished third. So a good showing, turned around the next election cycle and won and haven't looked back. So 7 at-large races, winning the last 6 consecutively.
Do you see, bringing up the issue that you're part of this community, that it hasn't been brought up before, but now you're running for mayor, and this is a much bigger, high-profile race?
Houstonians are looking for someone who can run the city. Houston has always been about the skills that you bring. One of the reasons that we are a growing city, that we're such an entrepreneurial city, that people come here from all over the world, is it that we're a city where we value what you do much more than who you are. I'm not unaware that I would be the first openly gay or lesbian mayor of the city of Houston, but I'm running because I want to be mayor of Houston and represent all the citizens of Houston. I love my job. I love this city. It is my home, and I hope it's my home for the rest of my life. I'll let others assign the elements of history to it. I just want to win the race so that I can have the job that I absolutely love.
If somebody wants to get involved in your campaign, how can they do that?
They can visit my website at aniseparker.com, aniseparker.com. Don't have a headquarters yet. We have a couple of locations that we're looking at, but that would be the best way to do it. Visit me on the web.
Aren't you on Facebook also?
I am on Facebook and other social networking sites. Be my friend on Facebook. That would be really neat. This is going to be an expensive race. It doesn't matter who we are running. This is a high profile, intense, expensive political race, on the order of $3 to $5 million
each.
We are for each of us. This is a major media market. We are the fourth largest city in America. Houston, 2.2 million people, larger than at least a dozen states the last time I checked. So I'm going to need, in order to win this race, or any of us to win this race, we're going to need lots and lots of money, lots and lots of volunteers, and lots of folks willing to vote for us come November. And the election is in November, so we have a lot of time to talk about the issues.
Great, and we hope to have you on again.
Absolutely.
Anise Parker is running for mayor, and if you're interested in getting involved, you can go to AniseParker.com. And thank you for joining us this evening, and you're listening to Queer Voices.
It's always a pleasure.
I'm Donna Ann Ward.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending February 7th, 2009. The first judicial salvos have been fired against the U.S. Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, a bill passed 13 years ago by Congress and quietly signed into law by President Bill Clinton. It bans any federal recognition of same-gender unions, including marriages in states where they're legal, as well as domestic partnerships or civil unions. Judge Stephen Reinhart of the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled this week that DOMA is unconstitutional, and that Tony Sears, who legally married Los Angeles federal public defender Brad Levinson last year, was entitled to the same spousal benefits given to heterosexual couples employed by that department. The court's chief judge, Alex Kozinski, also granted benefits last month to Amy Koenigis, the same-gender spouse of Ninth Circuit Court staff attorney Karen Golinski, but sidestepped constitutional issues in his ruling, saying it was based on the vagueness of a federal statute about whether benefits could be given to someone who wasn't a family member. The decisions apply only to the two couples because they were administrative dispute resolution cases rather than lawsuits. But according to some legal analysts, they suggest that DOMA won't pass constitutional muster if it reaches other federal courts. They also predict that the rulings will put pressure on the Obama administration to push for repeal of the act, something that's already on the new president's agenda.
The two couples, among some 18,000 couples who married in California last year during the few months it was legal for gays and lesbians, await the ruling of the state Supreme Court in a case challenging the constitutionality of Proposition 8. That November voter-approved ballot measure reversed the High Court's May marriage equality ruling and constitutionally defined marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Its defenders are also asking the court to nullify all existing same-gender marriages. The justices announced this week that they'll hear oral arguments in the case on March 5th. They will then have 90 days to issue a ruling. A total of more than $83 million was spent during the fight over Proposition 8, according to the latest campaign reports made public by the state this week, which far exceeded previously released figures. It was already declared the most expensive ballot measure on a social issue in U.S. history. The final tally showed that opponents of Proposition 8 raised $43.3 million in 2008. The measure's sponsors raised $39.9 million. The Mormon Church, whose support for the measure has raised the most ire among equality advocates, barely reported by the filing deadline an additional $189,000 in contributions to the Yes on 8 campaign. The church had previously denied any direct financial support for Proposition 8, beyond about $2,000 for bringing a church elder to California. It has never denied, however, that millions of pro-Prop 8 dollars came from individual Mormon donors. The state's Fair Political Practices Commission is investigating charges that the church has failed to fully report its organizational financial support for Prop 8. The biggest donor to the Yes campaign, according to the new figures, was the Knights of Columbus, the political arm of the Roman Catholic Church, which gave $1.275 million. The Colorado-based rabidly anti-gay right-wing evangelical group Focus on the Family reported $657,000 in contributions.
Meanwhile, bills to legalize same-gender marriage have been introduced in Vermont and Maine, and a legislative committee held hearings this week on a marriage equality bill in New Hampshire. Similar measures are also expected to be considered this year in New Jersey and New York. The Hawaii House Judiciary Committee unanimously approved a civil unions bill this week that would grant same-gender couples all the rights of marriage except the name. 32 of Hawaii's 51 House members have announced support for the measure. Its fate in the Senate, however, is uncertain. But the newspaper The Oregonian reported this week that only about 20% of eligible same-gender couples have signed up for registered partnerships in that state, where they've been legal since January 2008. LGBT activists say that the law may not be enough for many couples, and that some are probably waiting for full marriage equality in the state. The Wyoming House rejected a bill this week that would have allowed voters to decide whether to amend the state constitution to deny legal recognition to same-gender marriages. It failed by a vote of 35 to 25 after frequently emotional debate. Wyoming law already limits marriage to one man and one woman. The Iowa Supreme Court is also expected to rule on a marriage equality lawsuit this year.
The Delaware Supreme Court unanimously rejected a lawsuit this week by a lesbian seeking joint custody of her former partner's adopted daughter. The justices said that the woman had no standing to petition for custody in family court because she is not the child's legal parent. The High Court held that, under Delaware law, a person who is considered a de facto parent of a child does not have the same rights as a legal parent and thus is not entitled to custody. The justices noted that the issues in the case apply to all unmarried partners, but that it was up to lawmakers in the General Assembly to change the statutes.
A New Jersey Superior Court judge has ruled that a woman in a same-gender Canadian marriage can file for divorce in the state. Only married Canadian residents can file for divorce there, but the country does recognize divorces approved elsewhere. One of the estranged partners wants to remarry in Canada, but can't do so without a divorce from her former spouse. It's unclear if the state will appeal the ruling.
The Boston Herald reported this week that the lead plaintiff couple in the historic 2003 Massachusetts marriage equality ruling has filed for divorce. Hillary and Julie Goodridge will share custody of their now 12-year-old daughter, Annie. The couple wed in May 2004 after nearly 20 years together, and neither has responded to requests for comment. High-profile Boston divorce attorney Gerald Nissenbaum, who doesn't represent either woman and is also a Herald columnist, told the newspaper that, "Whenever there's a cause that keeps people together, once the cause is over, in my experience, there's a high rate of dissolution of the relationship. It's sad, but it's real," he said, adding, "And what a surprise, gay people are like everyone else."
In New York, a Manhattan surrogate court judge ruled this week that the survivor of a legal same-gender marriage is entitled to his deceased partner's estate as its sole heir. The two men, who were together for almost 25 years, legally married in Canada in 2008. None of the deceased partner's blood relatives contested the inheritance. The ruling is consistent with other recent state court decisions that legal same-gender marriages contracted elsewhere must be recognized in New York. Governor David Paterson ordered all state agencies to do so last year.
The Czech Republic's CTK news agency reported this week that a total of 712 same-gender couples, 510 male and 202 female, have entered into registered partnerships in the country since the law creating them took effect on July 1, 2006. Almost a third of the registrations took place in Prague. The Czech Republic divorce rate among heterosexual married couples has reached about 50% in the past few years, but only 2% of the same-gender registered partnerships have been dissolved since they first became available. The author of the registered partnership statistics called them a great success in comparison with the number of divorced marriages.
In other news, leaders of the 80-million-member Global Anglican Communion, meeting in the Egyptian coastal city of Alexandria, agreed this week to continue to disagree about the place of LGBT people in the church. The controversial consecration in 2003 of openly gay Bishop Gene Robinson of New Hampshire by the U.S. wing, the Episcopal Church, and the blessing of same-gender couples by some of its congregations, as well as by some Anglican churches in Canada, have brought the Global Christian Fellowship to the brink of schism. Statements released at the conclusion of this week's five-day meeting by the Anglican archbishops or primates urged their churches to maintain a 2004 moratorium on consecrating other openly gay bishops and blessing lesbian and gay couples, but also criticized conservative Anglican provinces, primarily in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, for welcoming the affiliation of four traditionalist U.S. dioceses and dozens of individual parishes who've defected from the Episcopal Church over its progressive stance on LGBT issues. The Episcopal Church's top governing body, the General Convention, will formally address the contentious issues during its July meeting in Anaheim, California. The statements from Alexandria deplore the current state of the Anglican Communion, saying, "Positions and arguments are becoming more extreme, and that rivals are engaging in fear-mongering, deliberate distortion, and demonizing."
And finally, the first openly gay person to become a high court judge in Australia has been forced into retirement after 13 years on the bench. Michael Kirby was praised during a farewell ceremony this week by Australia's Attorney General Robert McClelland as someone who will hold a special place in the history of this court. Kirby, who paid tribute to his colleagues and his partner for more than 40 years, Johan van Vloten, was legally required to retire by March 2009 when he turned 70. He often took Van Vloten to state functions and said in a 2007 interview that everybody's getting used to it. Prejudices and dislike will, ultimately, only recede, Kirby said, when gay people themselves break the spell of silence and stand up to be counted.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 7th, 2009. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, love it or hate it, this weekend is Valentine's Day.
And is it really?
Yes, and I know people that dread it, and they're like, I hate it.
I'll be home again, all alone.
But there are some community events out there.
Oh, well. For people. Maybe somebody will call and ask me out.
Or maybe you can attend an event that's coming up.
Really? What? Like what?
It is the Lesbian Health Initiative.
Oh, they're great folks.
They are great.
They do such good work. Well, y'all are here.
Yes. This is Brian Lavinka and Jennifer Renee, and we have in the studio tonight Skye Balboa and Ann Pinchak. Skye is the Secretary of Lesbian Health Initiative, and Ann Pinchak is a board member. And they're here to tell us all about this wonderful Valentine's dinner. So, what's going on?
Well, the dinner is a dinner and a dance this Saturday at the Renaissance Hotel. And, Jennifer, you can come with or without a date.
So, is it just lesbians, or could it be, like, gay men, or is it?
Yes, and
it's open to everyone.
I see. Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, tickets are still available, and you can pay cash at the door, or you can go to lhihouston.org and get tickets now.
What size of event is this?
It's about right now about 300.
Oh, that's a nice size.
It's a good size. Yeah. And there's an entertainer, Suzanne Westenhofer.
Oh, my God. I love her.
She's a great comedian.
She's like a superstar lesbian comedian.
Yes.
Oh, she's so funny. Yes.
So for our listeners out there that may not know about Lesbian Health Initiative, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this is our 17th year in the community.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And we've done, to date, well over 750 mammograms. Hmm. We collaborate with Legacy Clinic, and we also, MD Anderson, mobile mammogram program. And we offer well woman exams. Well, we do pap smears, also the... glucose checks, we do cholesterol checks, we do blood typing there on site, we take vitals.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anything, as far as they do happen to have a physician, then the results will be sent to that physician or to Legacy once they are returned, the mammogram results.
Now, you said they can and you can, but where?
This is at the Legacy Clinic.
At the Legacy Clinic.
We have two...
Y'all function, do all of this at the, in conjunction with the Legacy
That's
Clinic.
Correct.
Okay,
That's
just
correct.
Want to make sure.
And we have two health fairs a year. It's always the first Saturday in June and November.
Okay.
So it's, you know, open to all the GLBT community. And I think it's a great service for those that cannot afford medical insurance.
Mm.
For those folks that are self-employed, you know, and can't afford it.
Or can't get it.
Right.
Now,
so it's a great program.
Now, how did this all get started? Was there a need in the community, or what kind of caused this to come to being?
Actually, one of the founding members was Pokey Anderson.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And she felt there was a need for the community, you know, because a lot of us don't have that service again. And as gay women, you can relate, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. You go to the gynecologist and, you know, you're so butch in appearance. Sometimes you feel a little uneasy. Not you, personally. But, you know, you feel embarrassed, shy to be right. sitting there in a room full of 20 feminine women, so I think it's a comfortable setting.
No, I don't. No, I don't.
So it offers kind of an environment that's welcoming and non-judgmental. And
right, that's okay. correct. That's
it
correct.
Does, and especially in this economy, as more people are losing their jobs in healthcare,
yeah.
Then it's just vital to have an organization like LHI that gives these free services.
Now, what other sort of events do you do throughout the year? I mean, fundraising events. Is this your major one, or...
Well, it is the major fundraising event. We also get support from the Black Tie Dinner.
I wonder.
From Pride.
Good folks.
Yes, from Kindred Spirits Celebration and from other organizations as well.
Charles Armstrong Investments, 12 Days of Christmas.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Charles. Good. Yes. Glad to hear that.
I mean, there's not very many lesbian organizations. There's maybe two or three that I can think of.
Correct.
We've had them on the air, but I mean... I'm glad to see that this need in our community is being met. And, you know, having a great event like this weekend is a good way to not only have a good time, but also help a good cause.
It is a good cause, and we always like volunteers.
Okay.
If people want to come to the health fairs, help us out, become active, we would love that. It's an easy way to get involved without a huge commitment of time.
And how can they get in contact with LHI?
Well, they can... call 713-426-3356 or go to lhihouston.org.
Very good. And what sort of volunteer opportunities would just at the health fairs, or like do they get into helping people or patients? Or
well, they could volunteer at the health fairs. Mm-hmm. And many of the members actually help with organizing it, doing some of the screenings. There's also organization for events, newsletters, helping with the website. There are all kinds of opportunities to volunteer for all kinds of our events.
Now, what if somebody wants to become a member of LHI? How does that work?
We have the first Tuesday of the month, and we usually meet at Resurrection.
Okay. MCC.
Resurrection MCC.
On 11th Street.
Right. So we're there every the first Tuesday of the month. That's when we hold our meetings. And anybody's welcome to come and see what we're all about. And again, you know, they're welcome to go to our website, like she said, LHIHouston.org.
It's easy to remember.
for more information, and we'll be more than happy to have anyone come on board.
Yeah. What kind of numbers have we been seeing over the last few years, 17 years of when you're servicing? How many is it? A lot, large numbers of women that need the service that just can't get it, or are things getting better at all, or are they getting worse?
Well, you know, we were experimenting the last couple of years where we were offering certificates for them to actually schedule an appointment and come back to
Legacy. Okay.
For a well woman exam, and we found that a lot of people have a problem with transportation, and I think they would prefer to just have all the services that same day. So we try to schedule their mammogram with the mobile unit,
mm-hmm.
and also they can do that and then come back in the clinic, sit there, wait, and have their well woman exam. Now, most of the members, we conduct the diabetes checks, the cholesterol checks, the vitals, and the blood type, and we do that ourselves. And the majority of the members are involved or have been involved with the medical field. But if not, you know, we just train people that come in and volunteer.
So you have medical volunteers, people involved in the medical system here in the
that's
city.
That's correct.
They just volunteer to be there and
yes.
to help and all that. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. That's opportunities for some people in the medical field to give back to the community.
Absolutely. So tell us more about this weekend. It's at the Renaissance Hotel, mm-hmm. in case our listeners may not know where that is.
It's in Greenway Plaza.
Okay, so that's kind of that tall, skinny building off of 59 in like Edloe, I guess, over there?
Yes, it's Edloe. And
it's across from the church.
That big old massive church.
Yeah, and there'll be music by DJs Unlimited.
Okay.
So it's dancing and then the comedian as well.
So tell us, it starts at, you said
6:30.
It starts at 6:30. It continues till 12:30. There'll be a very nice steak dinner, very
Ooh,
nice
yes.
dessert.
Ooh.
And
is that provided by the hotel, or are you having a caterer? Or how?
We cater.
Okay.
We cater the dinners.
Oh,
and
really?
The hotel will offer us a menu. We go and test whatever items they have and go from there.
Oh, so, that's fun.
We have a mango cheesecake type dessert this
Ooh.
Year, so it's kind of really great.
I might go to just eat.
Oh, you had me at food. I'm just all about the food. So. Now, talk about the attire. Should people dress up in like their finest, like Valentine's red satiny dress, or what should the people wear?
They can. It's dressy to formal. No blue jeans or t-shirts.
Now, ladies, do we have to? Have you had that in the past?
You know, women.
Hey, well, you're embarrassed there. You
I'm
may
sorry.
Shut up and.
Well, it has happened.
Yeah.
You know, and I would like to think that in the community we're just casual. We'd like to have
yeah,
a
exactly.
good time.
This is Houston. It's very casual.
Exactly.
So
you know, we're just there really to have a great time.
Yes.
Of course, we want to have a nice event.
Right. Well, jeans are Texas formal, isn't it?
Right.
Okay.
The boots, okay. you know, a nice vest.
Yeehaw.
That's if they're pressed.
Oh, yes. That's a whole science.
That's a whole science in itself, trying to get those. Never mind.
Now, how many years have you done this? Is this, what year is this, for this dinner?
Now, you've been around 17 years.
This is our seventh game.
The seventh one.
Seventh,
oh,
yes.
Good.
Very good.
And where do you other events coming up? Now, we've got this event this weekend. Is there anything coming up after this that we want to talk about at all, let people know about?
Aside
from if they miss this opportunity, what's next on your...
Well, we do we try to connect with kindred spirits. We're
mm-hmm.
involved with them. You know, they have the golf deal going mm-hmm. on. And so we try to back the community, other events. But as far as LHI is concerned, we have our health fair in June.
Mm-hmm.
We do a newsletter. So we also would love to have volunteers to help us with that because, you know, we have to do the stamps, the seals, and everything ourselves.
Right.
So, you know, again... I mean, to reiterate that it would be great to have people come out here and just at least check our website and see what they can, you know, extend.
And that website again is?
LHIHouston.org.
Now, do y'all do anything for Pride? Do y'all do a float or anything?
You know, we have. Actually, last year we did not, but we have been involved.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we go to the Houston Women's Festival,
mm-hmm.
and we set up our table. We hand out literature, which we also do at the health fair.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer, you mentioned as far as medical people volunteering. And we have had a couple of dentists come out, and they do oral screening for cancer or whatever.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
So, you know, again, I want to extend an invitation to the community. Whoever's in the medical field, if they would like to be involved, it would be great.
So your opportunity, listeners, is this Saturday for the Valentine's Dinner and Dance with comedian Suzanne Westerhoff.
Westerhoff.
Yes, she's awesome. And starting
don't
at
miss that. That's
that
terrific.
Alone
that's,
is worth.
That's a good laugh.
Absolutely. And there's a wonderful dinner with a mango cheesecake.
Ooh, that sounds good.
And information and tickets are available on the website. Is that correct?
If you go to our website, there's a link directly to PayPal. Because if you do wait until you're... We do sell tickets at the door, but it has to be cash.
Yeah, and you don't want to wait. You might sell out.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So sitting is actually tied right now.
Yeah, so there you go, listeners.
If you're going to do it, you better get it right now. It's only 5 days away.
Exactly.
You can probably still do it right now on the online.
On LHIHouston.org.
That's right. And a telephone number.
713-426-3356.
Thank you.
Sky
Thank both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you much for having us.
All right.
Thank
this
you.
Is Queer Voices.
What I Like About You, and that's from his 2003 album, Different and the Same. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
This way.
in case you're following along with us this evening, you can check out what's going on at the show here by going to queervoices.org. We have our complete schedule up there, including the music we plan to play. So just check that out. And also, if this is a little bit too late for you to listen to usually, you can subscribe to Queer Voices on iTunes and be able to get the entire show. Usually it's up there by the next day. With us this evening is Brad Odom, and even though it's only February, we are already talking about Pride.
Yes,
actually,
we are.
We sort of talk about it all year long.
It's a year-long thing, right?
Yep, Brad Odom is president of the Board of Directors, and this is your, what?
Second year as president, and about fifth year being involved in the board, so fourth year and change.
Is it as fun as you thought it would be?
Well, I enjoy it. I do. It is a love of mine and a passion of mine.
You know, you're the gayest Houstonian.
I guess I hold that title.
Yes, you do. So what's going on with Pride?
There's a whole bunch of things going on. One thing, we did just announce our theme, our logo and our theme, and it is Out for Justice. And you can go out to our website, which we just relaunched.
It's a
really good website.
I love it.
So pridehouston.org, go and check it out.
You know, this logo kind of has a Wonder Woman type flair to it, with stars bursting out.
It has a lot of fun superhero themes, and I think Out for Justice has two different sides to it. One is, of course, the political arena that's going on today, but really, we also always like to have fun, and so we have an edge of superheroes, and the idea of what a superhero is to you, and who might be a superhero to you.
So you might
see some of that coming out.
Absolutely. Now, I understand that we have a tough race right now for grand marshals in all of the categories. I've heard fierce campaigning on many, many fronts.
I don't know that there's been as much campaigning as there has been this year, and it's been kind of exciting to see people get involved early.
It's crazy.
It brings people closer into Pride. And
if you're on Facebook, there's groups for each candidate, and it's just like out there gunning.
We're excited that everybody's getting involved in it and excited about it.
And how can you vote?
There's a few different ways. One is at many of the various locations. You can go out to our website and you can see, first of all the different nominees, their bios, and learn a little bit about them. You can go out to one of the sites, one of the locations where we'll actually be on site. In fact, you just heard about the LHI's dinner and dance. We're actually going to be there.
Great.
And you can vote while you enjoy your Valentine's Day evening there. We'll also be February 6th. That was just passed, so we missed that one. I'm looking down my list here. February 20th, we'll be over at Chances. The 21st, Club Eden. March 4th, Meteor. And March 6th, the Sisters Softball Tournament. So trying to do some diverse things, not always being out of the bar, trying to have some other opportunities as well. Always on Thursdays in the evening, and on Saturdays from 10 to 2, you can just come by the Pride office, which for now is at 1415 California Street.
And what's the scoop on that? Can you say anything about that?
Well, what I can say is that we are in the search for a new location. Legacy, as everybody's been aware, they're working to change that building, and and they have a beautiful building plan for that space and combining all their services into that space. And so all the tenants have been let known now that they need to find a place primarily before April or May. We're looking to get it a little bit faster because that late is really hurts into the Pride
season.
So,
Pride, yeah.
Yeah, so we're trying to, we're actually going to vote on a couple locations tomorrow night at our board meeting, which I ought to also mention. The second Tuesday of every month is our production team and board meeting. If you want to come, it's an open board meeting and open production team meeting. We're always looking for additional volunteers. It starts at 6:30 and is also at 1415 California.
And that's just one block north of Westheimer, between Commonwealth and Waugh.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
The other thing, I guess, with volunteers, the other side of how we operate is money. So we're always looking for sponsors and donors, and there's a few different ways to donate.
Well, please tell us more about this, Brad.
It takes about $250,000 to put on the parade and festival every year. and really a bulk of that money is just in that one day, between security, fencing, you know, all, and all the other operations that have to go on that day, cleanup crews to pick up after us, and then our office and operations throughout the year. So
and you should probably make a point of that you talked about cleanup. It's always been the mission of Pride to keep the place cleaner after they leave the parade and festival, so that everybody in the neighborhood is happy with what happened the day before.
Exactly.
Well, you put 100,000 people at the corner of Montrose and Westheimer, you're going to have a mess.
Unfortunately, it is a mess at midnight, and there are crews that stay all night until it's all cleaned up.
That's like putting the city of Beaumont at that corner. I mean, it's just a huge mass of people.
Yes, and with that, if that huge mass of people, if every person just gave $1,
$1 or $2,
we wouldn't even have to go out to all the corporate sponsors, and we wouldn't be asking for money year round. But because we don't get a dollar from everybody, we have a couple of different ways that you can make donations. First of all, you can join our causes site on Facebook, our causes group on Facebook, and you can donate straight through that. And then also we have a new group called Club 5000, and you'll see it when we're out at different events. Club 5000 is our goal to get $5 from 5,000 people. That would raise $25,000, and there are a couple of initiatives that's going directly to. One is a health and wellness tent, and the rebirth of that, and the history tent. So those are two great causes and great events that we have at the festival, and so your $5 would make a difference, and that's not a whole lot to ask whenever you're out at the bars or having a drink.
It's much less than a cocktail at some of those bars.
Exactly.
Not that I would ever know. So what changes can we see for this year in Pride? Any things that you're tweaking or adding?
Some of the things that we took very seriously, a lot of the comments and critiques that came out of last year, at the end of last year. And one of the big things is that we have a family retreat zone. And we're designating bleacher seating that is between Commonwealth and Yoakum, and the entire area kind of in front of copy.com.
Okay.
In that area.
Okay.
Is an alcohol-free zone.
An alcohol, wow.
And so it's going to be a family-friendly zone. And so, and it's going to be right next to, on Commonwealth, the festival's going to wrap around, and that's going to be where the kids' place is. Oh. And it's actually going to be family-oriented booths and things going on over there as well. So really kind of staying true to trying to continue to make it a family-friendly event, trying to curb some of the overindulgence that is always going to happen.
Historically part of Pride.
Yes. But
will the festival be free again this year?
The festival will absolutely be free.
That's awesome.
Again, last year we saw a change. We decided to make it free and open to the public. We took down the fences and went from about 3,000 attendees the year before to the city estimated 75,000 attendees.
I believe it. I mean, it's just...
Yeah. And that benefits everybody, because we were looking at who is in the festival, or nonprofit organizations,
exactly,
or different people trying to provide services to the community, and then you're excluding people by charging an entrance fee. So
right.
And
if you're going after the corporate sponsorship dollars, they're looking for impressions and people that they can touch. And if you have 75,000 people of a certain demographic, I mean, that's instant marketing.
And our corporate sponsors loved every bit of it.
I'm sure they did.
So they've come back strong again this year. So
very good.
That's been a very good.
Are you seeing any kind of issues with the economy and maybe changing the parade, or is it kind of staying the same? Or?
Well, we are cautiously optimistic. We are cautious in our budget and cautious in our estimates, and we have every part of the budget. I call them kind of. I described to our team that we're like a hot air balloon, and we've got sandbags, and what do we need to drop off in just case our hot air balloon starts to crash into the ground. And there might be parts of the budget or parts of things that we might want to accomplish that we're just not going to get to because the budget doesn't get us there.
Very good.
Well, so, and what is a parade? I know it's early so far, but the parade, what does it look like? Have applications already come in?
Applications are coming in. Festival applications are coming in. So we're real excited to see all of that coming in at kind of ahead of schedule.
You sound like you're last year. A little bit ahead this year in terms of, you know, maybe planning and just kind of everything.
I don't know. When I was here last year, wasn't quite the same conversation. It was a little bit scarier. Oh, yeah.
Well, let's be honest. Last year, you had to pay out a debt.
We did.
And you took care of that. That's a pretty incredible accomplishment.
We started out $25,000 in debt, and we ended up over $30,000 in the bank, and are able to function and support ourselves through the end of the year when there's, you know, really trying times. And
not bad for the first year, huh, as president?
And that was real trying. It's the first year of president, and a lot of people, you know, questioning and even people holding back giving because they thought that it was going to fail. And it was nice that now I can go back to even some people. There were corporate sponsorships even that they were coming at me and asking me about, well, where is this money really going to go to? And I said, you know what? I'll call you next year. And guess what? I'm calling them this year.
It's kind of you would almost say an Anise Parker style of financial management, kind of pulling it together and being responsible.
Yeah. Well
good
know.
Job. Yeah, we were, I know last year we were kind of like, well, is it going to be around for another couple of years? But
And I'm happy to say it is, and we are, and Saturday, June 27th at 8:45, on time, on cue, we will step off, and come on, right on down Montrose. The parade does run from Dunleavy to Crocker.
Westheimer.
Did I say Montrose?
Yes. I know we interchange them sometimes.
Yes.
But it's in Montrose.
Westheimer. And I also always say that somebody's first pride. That's kind of the drive within me that makes me want to make it always bigger, better, or at least as good as last year, and really take care and care with pride. Because there's that moment that you probably all remember the first time you went to a pride and saw all those people. And there's never a space where you see so many people who are supporting and loving and caring of you and who you are, and it's just okay. And that means a lot.
It's the gayest thing in the world. That's why I live in Houston.
I think you said that twice now, though. I'm the gayest person.
Now, let's talk about the website again. What is the address?
StrideHouston.org.
I love the website.
And it is. We are blessed with a very talented designer who took on the challenge of having it live by the beginning of January. And I was pleasantly, and I'm just amazed with the things that it can do, mm-hmm. and how we can better utilize our information and get information coming out better and clearer.
And so for our audience members that are on Facebook, there's a group for Pride Houston?
There's a Pride Houston group on Facebook. We have our MySpace. We have Twitter. And one of the things neat things about Twitter is that the updates from Twitter are actually just general news pieces as well. So it's not an update every day about Pride stuff, but it's also just about general community news.
Very good. So you're kind of on the technological edge out there, it sounds like.
They are. I'm learning.
Oh, Brad.
The other big thing that's coming up right now is Pride Idol. Pride Idol is a 7-week long event leading up to Pride, and it is a kind of American Idol type event. Every year we've actually have some really good prizes. It's been two round trip tickets on Southwest Airlines in the past. We're working with them to kind of have the same thing again this year, and a nice little a recording gig with Leadhead Productions and Alan Lett. So, you know, it turns out to be a nice prize package if they take advantage of all of it, and that takes place over at Guava Lamp. Mm-hmm. I think I'm allowed to say that. I think that's been decided. I'm not sure. I'll find out tomorrow, maybe.
I guess we'll find out.
Maybe. That's coming up, and be on the lookout for ways to sign up if you are a talented singer and want to get out there and get seen.
And there is a kickoff party coming up at some point?
At the end of March. That will be when we announce our grand marshals, and we kind of get everything ramped up into full gear.
I see. Very good.
So if somebody wants to get involved, how can they do so?
They can go to the website, PrideHouston.org, and sign up there. They can find us at one of the times when we're doing the grand marshal voting, and they can sign up there. Or they can come to our production team meeting, or just walk in the door on a Saturday between 10 and 2. We're always having volunteer sessions on the Saturdays as well.
And you're also doing voting till when?
We are doing voting until... That's a good question. It's the... basically the end of March or late March.
So there's still a lot of opportunities.
There's still a lot of opportunities, yes.
A lot of campaigning, I'm sure. That's getting...
to get all of your friends together to vote for you.
Yes. Absolutely.
Well, and in case somebody doesn't know anything about Pride here in Houston, we do have this unique thing of the night parade that has been going on.
Tell us more about that, Jack.
Well,
how did that get started?
How did that get started?
Yes.
It started actually in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
I remember the old days when it was like the March of Death.
Yes, on a
like
Sunday afternoon.
Like the 90s? Oh, my God.
Yes.
It was horrible.
Well, and we did something very unique for this part of the country, we basically copied what Sydney, Australia did.
Brought it to the United States. Brought it to Texas, which was totally appropriate because it's kind of like the coolest thing. Because even in June, it's hot at night, but it's nothing compared to the afternoon.
Nothing like.
And usually, if it rains in the afternoon.
Of course, and we had that.
It never rains.
That steam bath that keeps you all youthful and wrinkle free, but it's not very fun to walk around.
So it's a lot of fun. And is there still going to be throws? I know that's been something that's been talked about.
It has been talked about. We have not removed throws. We talked extensively about the idea of throws and passing things out. And limiting people or keeping people from... You have to pay extra to throw something. Mm-hmm. It's an additional thing on top of your... entrance into the parade. So it's not something that's standard, and if people want to add that in and they want to participate in that, we just recommend that it be something that's actually marketing for you, because I wouldn't want to take back from anybody, any organization that's trying to get their word out to pass out something that tells more about them. And I think that's really kind of some of the spirit of what those are, is
and
being
it's
able to get information out.
Ideally that
and
people then, want.
And something that ideally that
now,
people want.
Riding on my fair share of floats, the most popular thing are glow sticks or glow necklaces. That's like candy to everybody. So if you can advertise on those.
Put your information on that.
If you can do that, you'll be very popular.
Yeah. And of course we always ask that please stay on the side of the street and wait for the thing to get to you.
Yes.
And not go out into the street.
It's crazy being on the float, and these people, all these hands are just coming at you, and they're just trying to grab.
That is one thing. Oh, and that's one thing we're changing this year as well. We're going to have fencing for the entire length of the parade route.
Really?
And that's something that's caused that flood of people. There's no barrier control, and so somebody standing there saying, "Please step back, please step back," just doesn't
so
work.
What if you see your buddy on the other side of the street?
You should stay on your side of the street.
Oh, man.
Or you can find locations where there's openings, and whenever there's a space in the parade, they let people across.
I see. Gotcha. That's good, because I heard some stories about near misses last year where people were just running in the street. And
there were concerns about that. There was even I was walking up to see what everybody was talking about, and there was a little kid running in front of a big float. And the drivers can't see see people down low, and they if somebody trips and falls, they're not going to see them. And it's really kind of a dangerous situation.
And that's exactly what Pride Houston needs, is some sort of national news story.
That's the one thing I really work hard on and pride on is that the next day there's nothing bad in the papers. So
no, USA all, Today, Pride Houston.
All good news, all
yeah.
good news.
Yeah. No, it's good. And you're doing a good job as president, I have to say.
Thanks. Thank you.
Great. So the next thing that's coming up?
The next thing that's definitely coming up is the Grand Marshal's announcement in late March, and then Pride Idol starts. And then we get into there's H-Town Strip, which if you went to that, it was the day after Pride. We're actually going to have it before Pride. We've learned that the day of Pride is sort of the end of everybody caring about Pride. Nobody wants to do anything
Everybody's
regarding
done.
Pride.
And
like, Pride it out. I wore all my
rainbows.
And
we're done.
Yeah, I don't want to think about it for a while.
And what's the date of Pride this year?
June 27th.
And you can vote for Grand Marshal through the end of March, basically, and you can vote online?
You can vote online. So you can actually go. We instituted some technology that can actually track that and control online voting to make sure that people aren't voting twice. And so you can either go to one of the locations or you can go right out to pridehouston.org, and there's a link right from the homepage.
Great. Brad Odom is president of the board of directors of Pride Houston, and he gave us an update of what's going on. And if you want to find out some more, you can go to pridehouston.org. You're listening to Queer Voices.
My family claims the right to know what's wrong with me. They say I'm not turning out the way the dead men to be. My mother's given up my marriage. My father's given up his son. The Holy One is way a woman loving women when it's said and done.
Woman, and that's from the CD from, get this, 1977, The Ways a Woman Can Be. And, of course, our thanks to J.D. Doyle for being the queer music librarian of the world, really, and his contributions to the show and providing this music to us this evening. And you can hear J.D.'s Queer Music Heritage, usually the fourth Monday of every month. And so coming up in February, that will be the fourth Monday of February.
This is Queer Voices.
And we're back. This is Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka.
And we have, and we're fortunate enough to have here in the studio, the person voted 3 years in a row for the male massage therapist in Houston, the best.
It's like a trifecta.
Yes, trifecta. Well, you have to be good to do it 3 times in a row.
Oh. Innuendo there.
I mean,
Jennifer.
Selected as the best male massage therapist, Tom Zeppelin. How are you again? Good to see you again. We interviewed you once before.
Thank you very much, Jennifer and Brian. Yes, I was on here, about 2 years ago, I believe.
2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That was at the beginning of your dynasty.
That was at the beginning.
Yeah. And one of the things, we're talking about massage therapy and all, and we were asking some questions just before we went on, who's had one, and Brian was talking about his experience with having massage therapy. One of my things is that when we talk about massage therapy, I guess one of the fears we all have is, okay, do I have to take off all my clothes?
What's the answer?
Well, the true answer is, to get an effective massage, I would say yes, in my opinion. Now, the good thing is that, we'll say for my female clients, is I give them an option. You know, I tell them it's best to take off their clothes because I get into the glutes. As I've discussed before, the glutes are the center pivot point of your body,
mm-hmm.
and inside the glutes, the gluteus maximus, which is the buttocks, the outer part of the glutes, we got a lot of pressure points in there. Okay, as human beings. And the best thing to do is to get in there with your elbows and break up the muscle tension, stress, and knots that you've got in there. The sciatic nerve and the piriformis muscle also runs in that area. And, I'd really highly recommend taking off your clothes.
If I'm a little on the modest side, can I leave my panties on?
You can. What I do for, even the male or the women clients is they can wear a thong or a bikini. That way, the gluteus maximus is exposed for me to get in and work on that area.
Oh, okay. And as I understand it, and then this has to do for us girls, that if you don't give the massage therapist permission, they stay away from your breasts? Is that?
That is correct. The state of Texas requires written consent between the massage therapist and the client that has to be signed in order for the therapist to do breast
massage.
So
if you're uncomfortable with any of the touching, those parts can be protected.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, good. Like so you girls, remember that.
Yeah, like on my women clients, all my women clients go draped, of course. And when they turn over, they're supine, which means they're facing up. The sheet is totally covered over their breasts, so and they're covered, so they're protected.
Okay.
Now, what are some of the benefits or pros of having a regular massage? I mean, what sort of things can that lead to in your life?
Well, I think in today's world, because of the way our economy is, because of Hurricane Ike, with all the things that have happened over the past, and even in today's world, we as human beings carry a lot of, we're stressed out. And it's because of our jobs, it's because of our just daily lives. And the benefits of massage are simply this. Probably most important is if you're fatigued, the massage is going to liven you up. It's going to reduce muscle stress, tension, and knots, break that stuff up, put your body pretty much back into balance. Mm. The key is putting your body back in balance, because if your muscles are tight and taut, by breaking that up, it will put your body back in balance, which is great. It also rids toxins out of your body, flushes out lactic acids, and creates the immune system to boost up, and all those things.
Now, I had read that stress, one of the things that we face, like you were saying, in everyday life, without Ike or the economy, there's still a lot of stress we carry around. But I understand that stress actually has a negative effect on our immune system.
It does. It does. And that's why I really encourage, even today, if you don't have the money to go get a massage, talk to a massage therapist that can maybe work a deal with you, give you a little discount and treat yourself, because it is imperative. It's, they say today that massage is great for health benefit reasons. They're even starting to put it on some of our insurance, such as under chiropractic. You know, they'll allow so many massage sessions, which I really highly, you know, recommend you getting.
Really? That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I'd never known that. And as far as getting a massage, what do? We call up, we look. How do we find a good massage, other than you being the very best?
Award-winning.
Award-winning and all. How do we find a massage?
Well, what I would do, if I, you know, since I'm in the business, what I would probably do, if I'm looking for, let's say, a massage therapist to give me a massage, I'm going to, number one, I want a massage therapist that's going to have a website. Okay, because on a website, you are going to be able to check out several things. You're going to check out their credentials. You will be able to check out whether they have any reviews, you know, what their rates are, what their studio looks like. And a professional massage therapist, or I would say a good massage therapist, is going to have all that stuff to be able to look at. If I was looking in the magazine, I go by, not necessarily because I want someone that's cute, but I would look at the picture, because a picture is worth a thousand words, okay? Okay. It really is. I look at how they're dressed, mainly. I would want them to be dressed professional, have a smile. And, you know, those are lead-ins to be able to pick a massage therapist.
Okay. There's a lot of shady ads, you know.
What about time-wise? How long is the normal massage?
Well, normal massages range between, we'll say, an hour to an hour and a half. Okay? I also offer 30-minute massages for those people that are fatigued in the upper back and neck area. But on the average, an hour to an hour and a half is the time frames that a massage session will last.
Now, is there anything? Are there different techniques to massage therapists, and if so, what's the difference in them?
Well, every massage therapist has their own technique. You know, in massage school, you are taught the basics, but then from there, you broaden your horizon. You know, like with me, I've taken sports massage classes and deep tissue classes. So therefore, I incorporated what I learned in basic massage class, mm-hmm. basic massage school, and incorporated that with my deep tissue and sports massage. So every massage therapist is going to have their own technique, okay? And it depends on the client, you know. Every massage therapist is different in their technique, and a client, you know, will just have to go out and try a massage therapist until they see if they find one they like.
Hmm.
Now, how did you get started in massage therapy?
Well, that's very interesting. I was an engineer for 18 years.
An engineer?
Really?
A field service engineer where I serviced MRIs and CAT scanners in hospitals. Hmm. And what happened was, is I just got burnt out with the corporate world, the corporate workforce.
The rat race,
exactly.
You got stressed out, didn't you?
I got very stressed out. And plus, being an engineer, it took a lot out of me after so many years.
I can only believe.
Yeah, and I decided to just take a break, and I took a year off. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So then I decided, well, you know what? I want to go to massage school. I'm going to try this out, open up my own business. And I stuck with it. You know, I had that determination to go in and do that. And I've, by the grace of God, become successful at it.
Well, congratulations on that. I mean, that's, and how many years have you been doing it now?
7.5 years.
Seven and a half years. Wow. Real success in 7.5 years.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Now, for an hour, how do you not get sore? I've always wondered that about massage therapy. Do you do your fingers, or do you do the elbows? Or?
That's a good question, Brian. A lot of people ask me, okay, do your hands get sore? And honestly, no, it's not about hands getting sore, because you learn to adjust. You know, most important thing that you're taught in massage school is to have proper posture. Okay, you have to adjust your table to a proper height for the massage therapist to be able to provide a massage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most important thing. And then I use, you know, you're taught to use your thumbs, your fingers, your palms. But most importantly, when you get in and do deep tissue sports work, it's all about knuckles, elbows, and forearms.
And those are powerful tools.
They are.
Now, I'd heard, what is a Swedish massage?
Well, Swedish massage is the basic massage that you're taught in massage school. And
pretty much
what that is elongated strokes used with the fingers, the palms of the hand, and the thumbs. To get in there and just pretty much elongated strokes through the muscle.
Okay.
There's several different parts to Swedish massage. There's petrissage, which is kneading with the thumbs, the palms of the hands, and the fingers as well.
They really can't. We can't see you out there. He's so, sitting there showing me while we're doing.
Yeah,
that. I promise you, you
with his big manly.
I'm hands on here.
Yeah. Yes.
But the difference between Swedish massage, what I've come to find out with what I do, I pretty much provide deep tissue sports massage. I find out that in the arena, that's what it's pretty much turning to today. More people are getting the deep tissue sports work because it's more beneficial. Now, of course, that's not for everybody. You know, there are clients that just like to relax and will like the Swedish, which is the lighter technique of the massage for more relaxation or spiritual purposes. But I would say, to be a conservative, I would say probably 80-85% of my clientele is all about deep tissue and sports work.
Now, if you haven't had a massage in a long time and you're under stress or have been under stress, do you recommend the deep tissue massage first, or you think that the Swedish more of the relaxation is what's necessary?
It depends on what the client wants, okay? And this is
where... Well, what would you recommend?
I would recommend a combination of both.
Mm.
You know, because what could happen is I could start out light, and the way I work my business is with my clients is I start out with a light to medium pressure and increment it. Okay?
Oh, okay.
So what that does is, what happens is if I was to go in deep right away, it would shock the muscle. It would cause the muscle to tense up.
I've been there, done that. Yeah.
And that's not what you want to do to the client, because they're going to say, ouch, they're going to be tight, then they're going to look at you and get mad. No, what I do is I start out with a light to medium pressure, and I say this to all my clients. It's all about the technique. You know, if I'm doing deep tissue work, which I recommend on all my clients, you start out with a light to medium pressure and build that pressure.
Well, I guess, especially if you've got a real knot in some muscle somewhere.
Exactly. You don't want to go in real deep right away, because all it's going to do is traumatize the muscle, traumatize the client, and that's why you increment it, because you can be just as effective that way.
Now, where do we carry most of our stress as far as our body and muscles are concerned?
There's three places in the human body where we carry our stress and tension, and those three places are in our traps, in our rhomboids,
what's that?
The rhomboids is the upper part of the back.
Okay, those muscles right behind your neck, right below your neck.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then the third place would be in our shoulder blades or scapula. Those are the three places where we as humans carry knots due to poor posture, stress, tension, sitting at a computer.
I was going to say, probably sitting at a computer.
Exactly. I have all of that. Stress, sitting at a computer, poor posture, all of that.
And we all do that. You know, we as humans, even myself, you know, we all have some sort of poor posture. You know,
What is it, you know, we're saying how beneficial it'll be, but what do I need to look for as far as, you know, being body aware? If I, you know, gosh, I'm hurting, I need to do something. What am I going to feel? Where am I going to look? You understand, we get out there and we're doing it, we're sitting at the computer, and it's sort of like that. The frog in the pot, you start heating it up, and finally you boil the frog. I don't know when I'm really hurt and need some help. What do I need to look for?
Well, sometimes there's a couple things. Number one, a lot of my clients that come to me say, Tom, I have a crick in my neck.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm.
I got one tonight.
I do too.
Or if you just feel, probably the other scenario I can give you is I'll have clients that say, I just feel fatigued. I need a massage. I'm wore out. You know, all of the above. I mean, if you have, like, and you'll know, like, we'll say for athletes or people that condition themselves at the gym, if you work out and you feel tight, and the next day, let's say you sleep at night, and then the next day you wake up, you have a crick in your neck and say, wow, I'm real tight. Or if you just ran a marathon, you know, there are so many different conditions why people get massages. And I think your body will tell you, and that will allow you to, that's when you pick up the phone and call a massage therapist.
Very good. You mentioned a website. Tell us about the website. What's the address for that?
The address for my website is zeppelinmassage.com. That's zeppelinmassage.com. And what I look for, like I say, on the website, I want a website to be easy. I want it to be easy to navigate through. Mm-hmm. I want something that I'm going to be able to go to. Oh, wow. Okay, let me click on his rates. See what his rates are. Let me check his credentials. Where is that at? You know, the ease of the website and the tools, that tool is just, it's magnificent. And my business, because of my scheduler, I have a scheduler tab where clients can now check my availability and schedule their appointment, has really, really helped out a lot.
Where's your studio?
I'm located at 2510 Whitney, which is about 4 blocks from here and 3 blocks from the bars.
Okay. Well, thank you. We've been talking with Tom Zeppelin, who is 3 times voted the best male massage therapist in Houston, Texas. Thank you very much for coming and visiting with us.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Tom.
A famous all-around author turns his gaze from the Red Planet to the Emerald Isle in a stage production with a queer twist later in the program. As a veteran of the avant-garde film movement of the 1970s, Steven Soderbergh is something of a gay pioneer in his own right. He's currently finishing a video called Standing on the Bones of Our Ancestors, exploring the role of the queer tribal elder. And as This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend discovered, Soderbergh is documenting more than history.
Steven Soderbergh, tell us about your current film.
It's a feature-length video in post-production exploring the altruistic or spiritual dimensions of what it means to be GLBTQ. June 27, 2009, it'll be 40 years since the Stonewall Rebellion in New York City. Prior to the Stonewall Rebellion, there was little open public expression of the lives of GLBTQ people. Since then, an unprecedented emergence of gay culture has transformed society and the global village forever. What my documentary looks at is 4 generations, 3 generations of out GLBTQ people. Of course, we know there are a bunch of little queer boys and girls running around, mm-hmm. may or may not realize it yet. But what happens to those people, you know, of my generation, there's 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond? How can we grow in more meaning and value to our communities rather than retire behind a gated community someplace, or if you're privileged enough to even do that, or mm-hmm. you know, in a single family occupancy dwelling, you know, downtown someplace? And what happens to those of us who are entering the province of old age? How can we contribute, you know, our experience, our strength, our hope, our wisdom? You know, we live in a culture of kind of age apartheid. I preface the documentary with a wonderful quotation by Joan Halifax, the anthropologist. She says, "The wisdom that we need to solve our problems lies encoded in the depths of our unconscious minds, but it must be evoked by elders who evoke our potential. Without realized models to evoke our archetypal depths, we are literally lost in the world. Throughout history, elders have served as beloved pathfinders, beckoning us to enter the province of old age in anticipation of growing strength and usefulness to society." I interview Dr. Donald Kilhefner, longtime, you know, warrior and gay activist, co-founder of the Radical Fairies with Harry Hay, founder of the first gay and lesbian community services center in history. I interview Christine Downing, a mythologist and psychologist, author of Myths and Mysteries of Same-Sex Love. Malcolm Boyd, for example, civil rights activist, mm-hmm. Episcopal priest, author of over 21 books, openly gay for his entire life. Tom Spanbauer, man who fell in love with the moon, pioneer queer novel. Clyde Hall, Shoshone, two-spirit elder and ceremonialist, talking about what's come to be known as the two-spirit tradition in traditional Native American cultures. And Yul Brown, who is sometimes, you know, considered the father of sociobiology, Harvard University professor, states in his book On Human Nature that gay and lesbian people carry the altruistic impulse in our species, that we carry something around the betterance and furtherance of other people that allows our species to keep evolving and move forward. You know, there are now 3 generations of post-Stonewall Rebellion GLBTQ people living out in communities. We are posed at a unique historical threshold. The ground has been prepared, and the health of our communities really depends upon fostering intergenerational relationship and dialogue. If we look at our you know, ancestors, no matter what lineage, you know, we're descended from, elders were revered. Certainly in indigenous cultures, you know, the elder is always revered as a culture carrier, the keeper of the traditions, the mysteries. And, you know, Yul Brown noted as how gay and lesbian people seem to be pushing the boundaries. And the roles that they seem to play, you know, fell around the arts, of course. Shamans, priests, theater, you know, has all of its roots in ritual and magic. Teachers, service industries. There's something innate that we carry, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of spiritual dimension that I'm exploring in the documentary, the spiritual dimension of what it means to be GLBTQ. Mm-hmm. And specifically in those people who have aged and kind of evolved through the crucibles of individuation and suffering. I mean, you think of you know, people like Harry Hay, for example, and the formation of the early Mattachine Society. Mm-hmm. That was not all so long ago, and those people, you know, were risking their lives.
Right, exactly. And the Daughters of Bilitis.
The Daughters of Bilitis, right. Right.
For lesbians, yeah.
I mean, we have a long ways to go. I mean, we're mm-hmm. still scapegoated in some of those heterocentric myths and stereotypes. The last thing I want to see is people assimilate, because truthfully, mm-hmm. I think we have far more to offer the dominant culture than the dominant culture has to offer us. Oh, it was a common assertion that the only difference between, you know, GLBTQ people and straight people is what they do in bed. Well, Harry Hay, you know, would say, well, that's probably one of the few things that's similar about GLBTQ people and straight people is what they do in bed. He used to talk about a subject-subject consciousness rather than a subject-object consciousness. You know, many people objectify. I mean, you look what Western culture has done to the earth, for example.
Right.
Everything is, you know, for the exploitation. And whereas people tend to objectify each other, often times gay people are objectified as who they want to have sex with. You know, the two-spirited people were often, you know, mediators between the realms of the spirit and the realms of ordinary reality. Revered for their counseling capacity, they understood both men and women's psyche, so they made perfect counselors. They were defined by a different quality of spirit, not who they wanted to have sex with. That's what I'm trying to excavate in the documentary.
It's not only important that GLBT people see this, but that our allies and people who maybe are on the threshold of wanting to learn but are afraid.
Now I'm in post-production, hammering out grants, you know, asking individuals, trying to raise funds for completion of my project. I'll probably do a couple of versions, one for broadcast and one, you know, I aim for a limited theatrical distribution, and I certainly could see it as a tool for gender studies programs, you know, mm-hmm. sure. through the universities. Mm-hmm. Contrary to being an aberration or mere sexual preference, being queer is important, substantial, and has significant spiritual, evolutionary, and social purpose.
That was filmmaker Steven Solberg in conversation with Dixie Trichel and John Townsend. For more information about standing on the bones of our ancestors, exploring the role of the queer tribal elder, go to www.standingonthebones.com.
And I'm Maria, and together we're Zrazy. And we're crazy about This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Are you signed up for our emailed This Way Out updates? We send them out every few weeks, briefly reviewing recent and previewing upcoming programming and dishing some behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show. We also send out weekly email messages describing the specific content of each program. All you have to do to receive one or both of these messages is email tworadio@aol.com. And be assured that we don't share or sell your email address or anything about you, and we never will. Again, to receive the occasional This Way Out updates or our weekly program information messages, ask for one or both by name when you email tworadio@aol.com.
Ray Bradbury's many celebrated novels include The Martian Chronicles and Something Wicked This Way Comes. But This Way Out's Chris Wilson discovered that something delightful this way comes when she sat down with the iconic American writer to discuss the surprising gay twists in one of his early theatrical works.
Ray Bradbury is probably best known for his prolific career as a science fiction author, penning such classics as Fahrenheit 451 and The Illustrated Man. But in addition to being known for his novels and short stories, he's also highly regarded as a playwright. Recently, Mr. Bradbury graciously invited us into his Los Angeles home to talk about the recent revival of his 1954 play, Falling Upward, which takes place in the contemporary Ireland of that earlier era.
For the summertime is coming, and the leaves are sweetly blooming, and the wild mountain time blows around the blooming heather.
I arrived in Ireland knowing nothing about Ireland. It's 55 years ago now, and John Huston brought me there to write the screenplay of Moby Dick. It was quite an adventure here. And when I got home from Ireland, about 3 months, a voice spoke in my head, and a voice said, "Ray, darling." And I said to that voice, "Who is it?" And the voice said, "Why, it's Mick, your cab driver that drove you from Dublin to Kilcock and back 80 or 90 times. Do you remember that, Ray?" I said, "Yes." And the voice said, "Would you mind putting it down?" So I began to write my Irish plays. I put them all together into Falling Upward, and it's my greatest Irish play so far.
In those days, the pub was the center of the community, and Bradbury wasted no time in immersing himself in the local culture.
I went to Heber Finn's pub in Kilcock quite a few times, and I used Heber Finn's name in this play, Falling Upward, and his pub is at the center of the play. I knew that pub very well, and I knew all the people that lived in that pub, and a lot of the names that appear in my play were the names of people that were in that pub 55 years ago.
And during the first act of Falling Upward, Heber Finn's is indeed a very traditional Irish pub, filled with the laughter, singing, and camaraderie that can only develop after years, if not generations. But the second act brings a surprise. Visitors who at first appear to have nothing in common with the locals.
Well, I talked to an Irish priest in a pub one night, and we somehow brought up the subject of gay people, and I told the Irish priest, "Well, I'm very lucky. A gay man has been at the center of my life. Charles Laughton, one of the greatest actors ever on the screen, became my friend and got me to writing a screen stage adaptation of Fahrenheit 451. So for Charles Laughton, I began to write for the theater, as well as Bernard Shaw. But Charles Laughton never mentioned the fact that he was gay, but I knew it, and at the center of my life was the curiosity about gay people and how they functioned and where they went and what they did. So at the center of the play Falling Upward, this group of people were gay, following somewhere around the world, suddenly appear in the center of the play. So that's one of the most delightful things, I think, about the play.
At first, the pub patrons react as though they're caught in an entirely different Bradbury story, confronted with aliens from another planet. However, as this comedic fable progresses, there's a subtle shift in perspective, and when the visitors ultimately leave, a little bit of summer is left behind. We asked Mr. Bradbury if he intended to make a statement with the story of Falling Upward.
Nothing in my life and writing is intentional. I do not write my stories. I do not write my plays. My characters write them. So there's no intent. I don't ask my characters, "Why are you telling me this?" I just listen to them. So the gay people came to me and told me what they wanted to say. I listened to them. I put it down. So I didn't write the play. The gay people wrote the play. Heber Finn told me exactly what he wanted to say about the world, about women, about priests, and I listened to him. So he wrote the play too. There's no message. I don't believe in messages. I wrote Fahrenheit 451 about not burning books. There's a message there. But I didn't think of the message. It came to me from the fire chief. So all my characters tell me what they want to hear is not what I want to hear. And the gay people told me, here we are, watch us dance, watch us sing, watch us walk. So I watched it. Very simple.
And they ended up in Falling Upward.
That's right.
The play opens in Los Angeles at the El Portal Theater on February 27, 2009, with plans for subsequent productions in other cities in both the United States and Ireland. Pat Harrington, best known for his role as Schneider in the U.S. TV series One Day at a Time, is the narrator Garrity, one of over 20 actors who make up the ensemble cast of Falling Upward. More information about the show is available at www.RayBradbury'sFallingUpward.com.
All I can say is gangway, here we come. It's going to be a great time. I'm going to be there every night for months, loving the play and loving the actors.
For This Way Out, this is Chris Wilson. Special thanks not only to my co-producer, Christopher David Trentum, and Ken O'Malley, whose music you've been hearing, but to Mr. Ray Bradbury, whose characters invite us all to Heber Finn's Pub, where laughter is abundant and visitors are welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, Donna Ann Ward, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Dixie Treichel and John Townsend contributed program material. Thanks also to Christopher David Trentum. Ken O'Malley performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KUCR Riverside, California, to TLC Yamba, New South Wales, WPRR Grand Rapids, Michigan, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Well, winter is over, especially here in the studio.
Oh, God, yes.
It's a sauna.
It's a sauna in here, you guys. Absolutely. Hey, anybody who's going to go to the Lobby Day in Austin?
The Lobby Day, when is that?
It's March 2nd. Quality Texas is organizing it for the GLBT community to go to Austin and lobby the legislature.
Isn't that Texas Independence Day?
It is Texas Independence Day. Very astute of you.
So it's kind of an independence movement for our
community. It is. There'll be training at the hotel on Sunday night, and then Monday, March 2nd, we'll all go lobby our senators and representatives.
Very good.
And you can find out more information by going to equalitytexas.org. We'd like to thank our guests tonight, which include Anise Parker,
future mayor.
Oh, no. City controller for the city of Houston.
We had Sky Balboa and Ann Pinchak from the Lesbian Health Initiative.
And Brad Odom, the board of directors of Pride Houston. And then Tom Zeppelin, who was the massage therapist, won the award of the best male massage therapist in Houston 3 years in a row by Outsmart.
Very good.
And we'll see you next week. And who do we have on next week?
We're going to have Adrian Garcia in the 9 o'clock hour to start off our show, the new sheriff in town.
Hey, the new sheriff.
You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Anyone interested in promoting human rights and freedom from oppression is welcome to join Students for a Democratic Society. Please contact us at stsuhtx@gmail.com.
If you believe in change through action, please contact us at stsuhtx@gmail.com.
You're listening to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
90.1 KPFT Houston, Texas.
Over 35 years ago, there was a young man in Rome, Italy, an oncologist, growing weary of wiping away the tears on behalf of his dying patients of that dreaded monster disease, cancer. This led him to observation and discovery of not just the cure, 100% surefire cure for cancer, but also the cause. He calls this and refers to this cause as the demon and the root cause of cancer. His name is Tullio Simoncini. Tullio Simoncini is not only a crusader and a scientist, but a compassionate physician that shows and can demonstrate positive results from his surefire cure for cancer. Hello, this is Patricia Pellicciotti of Rise to It Radio, formerly Vibes Mind Body Spirit. Tune in on Tuesday, February 10, from noon.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.